Thank you everyone for tuning in to this special recording of an Aleph Contemporary podcast. My name is John Sharples, and here we are at the Bindery in Hatton Garden on a Saturday, not because we are executing a heist, but because I'm here to talk to the artists Andrew Hewish, Jacopo Dalbello, and Anna van Oosterom about their exhibition Field Notes, which is currently here at the Bindery, also curated by Andrew Hewish, as well as being a participant. Nice to see you all. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Andrew has written the text for this exhibition, and I'll just read a couple of lines from the start of it, where Andrew says that these works are soundings of our times. They plunder sources using the language of collage to produce a collage of languages, written and visual. They produce for the viewer a world that is open and intriguing, from conversations overheard on the subway, text sliced from grand musings, glyphs and numbers dropped out of the everyday, marks from the masters, and bits of canvas sewn together. And so the thing that is the unifying idea in this show is the idea of collage and that mixture of languages. And one thing I wanted to ask all of you is, when can you first remember seeing a collage that made an impression on you? Which was the first time you saw a collage work and thought, yes, that combination of elements adds something more than the individual parts. And I have sprung that on you, so I have a suggestion of my own, if anyone needs time to think of one.
Well, I can say that.
Yes.
The first collage I really saw was when I was a student, and it was one of Rauschenberg. And I thought, that's also a way of making art. I had never seen something before. It was in Amsterdam. I'm from the Netherlands. In the Stedelijk Museum, and in the time I was studying, it was really a museum where a lot was happening. And since that time, I am attracted to collages.
Can you remember the components in the Rauschenberg?
It was big squares and a lot of red on a huge canvas. Later, I saw it and I thought, not as nice as I remember, but still a very good thing. I don't know the name of it.
Jacopo, can you remember?
I think probably the first I saw was probably when I studied art history and with the Dadaists. I don't remember anything in particular, which one in particular, but I remember that I found this way of putting together things that were originally part of a different context, putting them in this new context, and all this new meaning that could come out of this, that I found really interesting. And then it took me a little bit, I think, on my own practice to introduce this way of working, but it kind of happened naturally as I have a lot of different visual interests, and you know, it was just a natural way of bringing together all this interest within the same context. So yeah,
I've always been interested in the particular inheritance that Jacopo has as someone born in the Veneto, with the first name Jacopo, like Tintoretto, surname Dalbello, of the beautiful. So you just have this incredible weighty series of associations that you kind of have to find a strategy to almost escape from in the work that you make. And so collage has been always a natural way for you to work with some of those inherited components.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I work a lot with elements from the history of painting, which a lot also from the Italian context. What interests me is also to bring these images away from this kind of a heavy historical, you know, this way in which we look at them that is often connected to national pride and this kind of stuff, and actually reconsider for what they are, just images, you know. And when you reconsider, you know, how they could then be used, basically.
Yeah. Andrew?
For me, I used to collect posters from the wall that would show their layers, so that archaeology of the city, you know, the collage of the urban, which French and Italian artists post-war also exploited. But I also think some of the earliest might be Salvador Dali's montage, filmic scene, which reminds me of Anna's work here too, that it's collage, but it's also because of their filmic structure and framing, the subtitles from a movie you're not quite sure about. It allows in montage, and those two things in 20th century practice very closely together. And it urges meaning and archaeology at the same time, because there's always a historical drag in the elements that I use.
So I'll give you mine. I was introduced to the music of Simon Garfunkel very early in my life by my mum, and I loved the piece of theirs, which is the 7 o'clock news and Silent Night, and the fact, the absurdity of having the newsreader read about the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, and the very sentimental singing of Silent Night in parallel. There's something in the space between those two elements that I've always found really interesting, the fact that those two things could exist in the world at the same time, and encourages you to make a decision about which one is more absurd than the other. So that's in music, but I've always been interested in collage as a strategy. And another question I wanted to float for you all is it meaningful to describe visual artwork as poetic? I have a foot in the worlds of painting and the worlds of poetry. And in both, I see the words poetic and painterly being abused, because usually they're used in a vague, sort of meaningless way to say something of approval that borrows from the prestige of poetry as an art form, or borrows from the prestige of painting as an art form, without actually meaning very much. So what does it mean to describe a visual work of art as being poetic? Anyone want to take that one on?
If I think of my work,
yes.
I want to make the ordinary more beautiful. You hear sentences in the street and you think, what is this? You don't know the beginning, you don't know the context, you don't know how it will end. So when it is so isolated, it becomes very poetic, because the sentence is not finished. And for the rest, I'm not poetic at all, but I want to make the ordinary more beautiful. Yeah.
So, in that context, poetic has something to do with beauty, so,
yeah,
and something and something to do with being incomplete.
Yeah, because if I'm honest, I find poetry hard to understand. So this is very compact, and I can handle this. So that's it for me.
I think what you definitely do is recruit the viewer to complete what's going on by speculating in some way.
Yeah.
I would suggest rather than incomplete, it doesn't allow completion. It leaves it open to resolve constantly and continuously. And that's the completeness of the work. And for me, the lyric comes in here, which is a part of poetry. People don't necessarily decode the line of a song, but they let it wash over and continue to generate. And so the lyrical, I think, in this show is important. In all these works open themselves up to the viewer, but they stay open, and it refuses a conclusion.
Mm.
For me, I do read poetry, but I don't read it for meaning. In that sense, and in this show, you can see rhetoric at work, but it's a powerful rhetoric. It's a formal elements in play that don't resolve, but are very strong and have their own language. You enter into that language, but you don't enter into it for meaning. You enter into it for lyrical enjoyment, or play, or other things that poetry can provide.
Any thoughts on this? Yeah,
I don't know. I think images suggest something, like if you read a poem, of course, there's, you know, there's the combination of words with try to build something which a person can refer to, and the meaning of the open and let unfinished or, you know, unresolved. And I think often in an image you can also do that. So at this level, I think it works or can work in a poetic way if we consider the similarity between, you know, this two way of building meaning, maybe. So yeah, I think that could be like a parallel between the two.
One of the things I think that all three of you have in common is that you provide a platform of departure from which a viewer can then feel connected to something much bigger. It reminds me of, I like being near to water, and I think it's because even if you stand by Regent's Canal, there's this sense that this water actually, there's an unbroken line from where you are to the Sargasso or something. Like, it just allows a kind of grand departure. And that's how I feel with all of these things, which is something that's quite modest and small. It connects you to something that's maybe as grand as all of human knowledge and history. And that's quite a trick to pull off with quite, you know, modest materials. A bit of paper, some found material, some stitching. Are you consciously playing with any of that grandeur? You talk about grand musings, Andrew.
Yeah. As you say, these are a departure of somewhere, but they are all, I think, for all the artists in this show, at least for me, they are ground in their experience. And as you say, or as a phenomenologist would say, everything is connected. You get the sky, the bridge, the ground. And so given that these are effective observations of, or a playing out of experience of the world, and therefore the world is here. It might not look like the world, but as you say, hopefully it feels like the world.
When you're reaching for something or associating with something more grand, that isn't just the mundane world. So in your collage series, the one-liners, quite a few of them have classical architecture. And it makes me think about, well, you know, what is someone like Cy Twombly doing when they scribble the word Agamemnon into the middle of a drawing? Like, it's almost kind of ludicrously bombastic reach for something enormous.
And history is enormous, and yeah. He was playing with that enormity, but also that history immediately, like memory or moments, escapes our grasp or retreats from us. And so I think what is interesting about all of the artists here using historical material or historical references is there's a retreat of the original history, but it's brought into the now. So the diachronic of history is here. It's our time, and it's time.
Is it a confidence trick, I think, to put yourself in the middle of that history and not worry about whether or not you're kind of small and insignificant? Like, when you handle those big historical sources and those big historical references, yeah, how do you do that without feeling ridiculous?
Well, I don't know. I always thought when people ask me that, I actually thought that having moved to the UK and have the touch from this kind of historical context that was the Italian context, actually be in the university in the UK context, in which it's kind of art, the art you talk about is just contemporary also. And that actually gave me the courage, basically, to actually then go back to that history and be more at ease with playing around with it. I think that actually put away all this kind of reverence towards it, which now I can come back to it and feel, you know, and play around it with humor even, you know, without feeling this heaviness from it. So yeah, I think it was probably, you know, the context in which I was that has facilitated this way of looking at it. And
yeah, that's one thing I've always taken from your stuff, which is that it's got an egalitarian joy in which everything is brought down or elevated to the same level. So.
Yeah, I mean, what interests me is to... I bring all these elements from these different contexts. What interests me is to show that visual languages from different contexts have the same possibility for meaning. And once you put them in, for example, I put them in the same painting, then they will start, it doesn't matter from where they come from, they will be part of this new context and they can have a dialogue between them. So being the numbers, letters, maps, or fragment from a cartoon or advertisement or a work from the Baroque period, I think it creates basically, I don't know, just it shows that these are all different visual languages that can work together or, you know, interact together if given the possibility. And by doing that, you actually notice that usually the context in which they come from, it's you know, define their meaning really strongly, and in this way, you know, the meaning is sort of dogmatized. And by bringing them together, you kind of break this kind of a sacred contextualization, basically, that they otherwise have.
So, Anna, yours is a bit different in the sense that you're finding contemporary speech wherever you are in the world, rather than history. And is that a deliberate choice to use something that you hear day to day rather than some of this stuff that has some of these baggage, that the material that Andrew and Jacopo use?
Well, if I would look for sentences from older days, that means that I have to read. Well, I can read, but that's not the point. But
yeah,
that's different. Then it's already something on paper. This is just something I hear when I walk. And maybe I misunderstand, maybe I, because it's never in my own language. Oh, funny enough, when I walk in the Netherlands and I hear things, I don't find them interesting. Because I don't know why, but I cannot do anything with it. Here, I just hear something and I think I hear this and it has a certain kind of meaning for me and I just collect them.
So Anna, you just mind the writing down gesture. So when you're out and about, you have a notebook and you...
No, like this, in my telephone.
Yes.
With a lot of mistakes.
And immediately, as soon as you've heard it, you think, right, that's the sort of...
Yeah, because otherwise I forget.
And we're here sitting in front of a grid of your works now, and my favourite one is the sentence that's been included is, I didn't realise that you were thinking that far ahead. And it's, I think it is poetic in the sense that it really makes use of the silence that comes before that and the silence that comes after, because we're immediately dropped into this world with no context. And really, the visual doesn't provide a context either.
No.
If anything, it's a red herring, to use an English phrase. And yeah, well, immediately we want to speculate about who is talking to whom.
Yeah. You know, I have a folder full of sentences, so I don't even know where I heard it.
No.
Could be on a holiday, it could be here, I have no idea. But that's also the beauty of it, because otherwise, when I'm making my collage, I'm only thinking, oh, now I have to do something like that to go with the sentence. And that is not working, at least not for me. It has to be as, what's the word? I never know what I will hear and I never know what kind of sentence will go with my collage. It's not serendipity, but it's something like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
And although I've said that yours is a bit different in terms of not using so many sources that come with heavy associations already, actually, as I'm sitting here, there are exceptions to that. So running through quite a few of your works is the gentle pink of the Financial Times, or even the word times, I think, which comes from, and I suppose,
oh yeah,
there's a kind of playful commentary on the idea of a journal of record, something as grand as setting out our times.
With the collage, I never know what I'm doing. I only know that it has to be. It has to be good in my eyes. If I look at it and if you go, no, it's not working. So the times, yeah. Why did I do that?
There's information here. There's data. There's a flow of data, and it's dislocated in the way that Anna's using it, and that's juxtaposed with these very private dramas that are going on, and which is another form of data.
Yeah. You know, there's a flow of in it, in this collage. You see, if you look at it, you see someone walking, and yes, it's all in one direction.
Yes. Yeah, we're looking at an image, and the subtitles, to use that word, say, mostly I can't talk about my feelings at all. That's fine. It is obviously all in my head.
Yeah, I feel like that now.
Yes. And yeah, I'm very interested to say that you don't hear this in Dutch. These sentences, because you're in some sense, it's not pure serendipity, because you're actually probably slightly listening with the idea of this sort of work in mind. No.
No, because then there's
it's not random, because you're making a selection even when you're in the field.
Yeah, like when you take a photograph. Why do you take a photograph that minute and not the other minute? Mm. It's because you see something beautiful and you want to catch that. That's the same with me. I'm just walking in the street and then, hang on, what do I hear now? Oh, this is something I can use. I'm at home, I go through my folder and I think, why did I ever write this down? This is a stupid sentence. Oops, off it goes. So there's a constant deciding for me what will work or what won't work. But I never go out with my ears like that.
Right.
Or maybe I can hear something.
Which is a bit different for how you find your material, because we're talking about how you select those the words from the one-liner series. You are actually doing something that's a sort of systematic to find
yes,
those.
Yes, but it does chime with something that Anna said, where this is in Anna's second language, and there are particular statements that obviously provide a sufficient difference. And it's that maybe the distance of the language provides that sufficient difference. And then these particularly, I think, in Anna's work, they're particularly compact statements. But it's that distance and that difference that allows that selection.
Yeah.
And I think with my material, I look for books from the 50s or 60s where there is a particular kind, a particular way of speaking that produces a sufficient difference. So the statements themselves have in the same way that the images are dislocated out of history in these collages, the statements are as well. And so I look for a particular way of speaking that is not found now,
mm-hmm.
which is hieratic, declarative, very self-assured, very grand.
Mm-hmm.
But also in the selection is for me an attachment to the line, as in the way that it plays out theoretically in drawing and in practice. And it also depends on how it's printed. So if it's printed, I'd look for text that sits on a single line that can then be chopped, but then chopped further so that the grammar itself is deturned. It produces another difference, so it's doubly different.
And Jaco, how about you? Do you have system, a process for identifying the material you want to use, or is it serendipity, is it luck, or?
Well, I guess most works start with an input, which is, I found something which I like, a painting which I like, or a fragment, and then try to build something from it. Usually develop quite organically, and I had usually a big pile of books in the studio, so most of these images come from books. So I go to the library or whatever, and then I try to look thing that could build something with that original input. And with time, then the image developed. I will try to usually do some sketches on the sketchbook, and then I will start working. And but of course, the whole thing will actually change while I start working, because the scale, the material are not paper, basically. So it will evolve and change into something else. So there's always an input which give an outline of the image of how the painting will look like. And then it's just basically materials playing and developing on the canvas, basically.
Do all of you think it helps if your audience is visually literate or sophisticated in some way? I saw my favourite stand-up comedian last week, Stuart Lee, and he pretends to tell his audience off for being ignorant. And he at one point shouted, "Don't come to my shows if you don't know anything, because you won't find it funny if you do." And sometimes, Jacopo, maybe I look at your work and it makes me think, oh, there's a whole... First of all, I'm very happy with myself when I'm successful in the game of thinking, actually, I do recognize these elements. And so they are very flattering, I think, on people who get the joke. You know, people, a joke's always funnier if you're pleased with yourself for having recognized the elements. But there's always a hint to a body of knowledge that I'm actually don't have access to at all. You know, there's some taxonomy or reference that goes way over my head. And you deliberately put things in there that, how does it relate to systems of knowledge? And if you come ignorant, does that sort of stop you from enjoying it, do you think?
Well, I don't do it on purpose. I mean, this will imply some kind of elitism, which I don't want to put forward. It's just that's what interests me, and you know, and then that's the element I work with. I think there are different levels in which the words could be read, and the reference, and just one part. But I mean, these paintings in particular are basically the construction of figurative painting. I think this is what mostly they're about. So I think that could be recognized. Even if you don't recognize where this image comes from or whatever, I think there is a level in which I hope they are enjoyable at that level for everyone. I mean, I try at least to engage with the paintings. I see there is definitely a danger to it, I mean, in general with contemporary art, that it just addresses a particular group of people, which has a particular background and so on. So yeah, that's always a problem, I think.
But I think in the context of this show, particularly with the other works, the idea of decoding them is not the point.
Yeah,
so, exactly. Yeah.
So immediately, I think, the audience here would see that there is meaning at play, that meaning itself is being resisted, that whilst cues to meaning, such as Anna's photographs, that are then blended with other layers, there was information there, there was a code there, but it's lost in the layers, and there's no requirement to add or to decode. In fact, it's saying, we're not decoding, we're producing something new, and that newness is a pure visual enjoyment
experience. Yeah, I agree.
And you said something the other night for the private view for this show that I was interested in. So there was some debate about whether your grid of the one line of collages was itself a unitary work, or whether each component worked autonomously as an individual work. And you were definitely clear that individually they work, because actually you've seen the others too. So even if you take one home, you carry the others in your mind in some way, and it's a signpost to a bigger hinterland that you're aware of. And actually, that's something that could be said about all of these works, which is that they function as signposts sort of bigger hinterland that you were aware of. That's a
and you referred earlier to a form of knowledge, and that goes to the question around language here and how it might play out. Each of these works from each artist establishes a language, a very distinct language, which could be construed as a new form of knowledge or a new regularization of knowledge. And so certainly with the one-liners, I was playing with that idea of knowledge and its codification.
Another way in which I think it's meaningful to describe all of this stuff as poetic is in that, in the same way that poems, by being written in certain recognized forms, like whatever it is, a sonnet or a villanelle, in some ways invites every other poet who's ever written anything into the room with that poem, and these works, by making references to conventions that we're already aware of, it invites everyone else into that conversation, but also stands you clear of them. And I think you in particular, Andrew, like, I always think of you're very playful with what you might think of as a visual cliche. Like, so these works, the Cambridge Spring series and the you know, the Pavi Vapers series, it's almost like a joke about post-impressionism. So it's there are beautiful on their own terms, but you also definitely recognize it as being part of or a comment on our linear idea of art history that goes Monet, Vuillard, Bonnard, and you end up with Joan Mitchell and Christopher Wall. Like, it's a deliberate joke about our linear sense of what that is.
And that we are bound in history. I think, again, all of these works demonstrate, as Jacopo said, we're bound in history, but we can play with that and we can recognize that. We live in a world where everything is on our desktop. But as Jacopo was inferring, I think, that it doesn't flatten everything to nothing. It raises everything to everything. So everything is significant. But with using a visual rhetoric, this thread that's explored consciously and put out there consciously is also something that keeps space open. It's certain artists close possibilities down, and no one can ever follow that. And other artists that tend to remain in an art historical memory are ones that contribute to that language, that continue to be used and can continue to be vital.
Yes. Something else I wanted to ask you all about is originality. How important is originality, and what does it even mean? And in my world, the gateway to the copyright system is that whatever you're doing has to be original. And in our Western idea of art history, we privilege the idea of art being something that is new or bought from the blue, is different to what's come before. And so, you know, Anna, you use you combine found elements. And so, how important is originality?
Well, first of all, I stopped using images which are really recognizable, because you cannot do this anymore. So I use my own photos. I use my own painted material.
So that's interesting. You've deliberately changed the way you work because of a kind of cultural feeling that actually you shouldn't use other recognizable images.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There's a fantastic American collage artist, Sam Milton. And when I look at his collages, it's from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You see the actual magazine papers,
yeah,
you know, ripped out, and you can even see the price of you know, an advertisement. And I thought, well, you can never do this anymore. There will be certain someone suing you because you are using his image. But I love to look at it because it's showing you part of history. I'm using just my own material. That's the easiest thing. And I don't want to be original, because I don't think you can ever be really original. You're always using Everything you've seen, you're using. And that's okay, why not? You build on top of all the others who has, they have already discovered lots of things. And if you use it, why not?
Yeah, how important is
it? No, I definitely agree with that. I think originality is probably overestimated, I think. Any field, of work or of knowledge is always a cumulative enterprise. So, different people contribute in part to it. And for example, in art history, it's people learning from other people and getting influence. So you never start from scratch. Just already learning a language, this has been a cumulative process that happened, with time. And this, I think this happened in every context. I think with the copyright, of course, that's another way to formalize this kind of put a stamp on what originality is and what it's not, which I think
you're very clever because you use a lot of stuff that is way out of copyright in the public domain. If the artist has been dead for 70 years, then you're good to go.
I work also with sound, and I use, I don't know if you know, Plunderphonics is this basically approach to music in which you use fragments from recognizable on purpose pieces, and then you then reassemble in a collage way.
Yes.
Which that is way more dangerous because a lot of these artists got sued, and
culturally we have definitely arrived at a consensus that in music it's unfair to sample even the shortest of clips.
Just 1 second, I think even a 1 second could be like something that what I use is mostly work of the past, because in the past I was using also different influence from different contexts, and bring them into my paintings in a more organic way. Now I just want to show that also that art is something you make with a lot of influence, and I want to show this influence so directly that everyone can sort of see, oh, this comes from this comes from that. You can see this different visual language, just to play in the context.
And one of the things that is striking about your work to me is that despite the fact that it's grounded in remixing, it's actually very distinctively yours. And actually, Andrew does not have a trademark visual aesthetic. Anna's work is a lot newer to me, but so maybe you do have a trademark look, but you definitely immediately see your work and just the way in which the elements are combined, you know it's a Jacopo Dalbello, it's a kind of trademark appearance to them, and that's an interesting...
I don't actually know.
You don't know how well that is, no.
I have no idea, that's how... I don't know. I sometimes think that maybe I should try to step away from this recognizable style even, just to challenge my own practice. Yeah. But I don't know, this kind of happened organically, and that's with time it will change and evolve, but my people keep saying that it's still recognizable. There is a continuity, which I guess is fine.
That's good.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
And so Andrew's showing 3 series here, and there was a lot of talk the other night about, do you recognize these 3 series as being by the same artist? And then the consensus that people landed on was, yes, they share a sensibility. So my question for you, have you ever made an original work, Andrew?
It's not a word that I would entertain.
No.
And I wonder how much play it has. I think there's something romantic about it as an idea. For me, it goes back to your intellectual property foundation for the question, which is that presumably the sufficient difference is this a sufficient difference from wherever it started, etc. For me, that sufficient difference is in being able to step back from the work and think, is this sufficiently different to what I know?
Mm.
And to me, that's a personal originality.
But would you, I was going to say, but would you describe that difference, therefore, as being originality?
Yes, it's certainly original from me. If I recognize too much of myself in something or anyone else's work, it's not sufficiently strange. So I would work a piece until I find it sufficiently materially strange, conceptually strange, etc., so that it carries its own energy, it carries its own world.
I think what you said about Jacopo, about originality being sort of overdone and over fetishized, is definitely right. Culturally, we have this idea that ideas do come like bolts from the blue, and there is not enough collective humility that, you know, if we are seeing further just because we're standing on the shoulders of giants, which is the sort of thing that you were getting at. And even imagination is probably best thought of as being a reordering of experience than it is of actually creating something new. Like, a dream is probably, properly understood, is a reconfiguration of memory and stuff that's you and experience, rather than something that is a genuine new
creation. To me, there is something else in that. I'm always amazed when there's something new in the studio that wasn't there before. That amazes me. It's new.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a chair that's based on some archetypal chair, it's still new. That's incredible to me. That's creation. And then, yes, there's the individuated qualities that you're talking about is another thing. But yeah, creation itself to me is interesting.
Do you have any questions for each other based on this exchange? So I know that Jacopo was originally taught by Andrew, and Anna's come in.
Out of the blue.
It is a fan. But what we should say, what I maybe didn't say at the start was, congratulations on such a great show. It's very sensibly hung, and there is definitely something that resonates across the work that the three of you make that works.
I think one thing I would ask the other two to speak to is materiality, because it plays out very differently in the various work. And I remember when we first talked, you talked about the various transfer methods. Do you mind just saying something about that? That particularly the sensitivity and the laborious quality, incredibly time-consuming.
Well, first of all, I like the time-consuming thing, because in the meantime you can think what to do next. I use transfer because what you do basically is wrap a lot of the paper off your image. So you only are left with a very thin layer on which the image is. And then if you glue it on paper, it sinks into the paper. It's really very nice. And then if you can do another layer on top, and because it's so very thin, something from the background comes through. So you're just playing with the image while you are working on it. And for me, that's like painting with paper, mixing colors. And sometimes it goes wrong and I rub too much and you rip it apart. Yeah.
But that materiality and that meditative time around that use of that material is important.
Yeah, because otherwise you don't look at it. Then it's like working in a factory, and another one, and another one.
I like the way you describe it as a kind of fundamentally non-intellectual thing, because of course what we've talked about is quite an intellectualized account of what this work is, but you're saying that this is so, you know, you can think about something else while your hands are occupied.
Well, it's not ironing.
No. this doesn't come across in a podcast, but as Anna mimes the activity of doing this, there's a clear kind of joy in how that comes about.
Yeah. No, I'm always thinking of the image, because I see the image, and you see it becoming clearer and clearer. So that's why I never think of something else.
But as a result, they are very flat.
Yeah.
So to stand in front of these, it's not a big sticky mess of, mm-hmm. of cutouts, put one on top of each other.
Yeah.
In a way, I think that my one-liners are. Although I am also interested in that retreat of materials. So as you approach them, they look and are heavily layered visually, but they're also very flat, and I presume that's part of the thrill.
Yeah, and also sometimes I use newspaper, and I rip them because then the sides are, well, if you cut them, it's very sharp.
Mm.
But if you rip it, it becomes flat, and then you can use a paste, and then it really dissolves in your image you already have. And usually when I use newspaper, that's like a color, like red or blue or green, so not recognizable.
I definitely think that material lightness of touch also works, contributes to the metaphor of how open they are as works as well, and how undogmatic they are, and how, you know, they do invite the viewer to resolve them.
What I would like the viewers to see is the moment you come in, you think, oh yeah, that's a room.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stand in front of it and you think, a room? No, I don't see a room. What is it actually?
Mm.
That's what I want to do with my image. The image I make, just to let them look and reconsider what they are seeing. Yeah.
And with Jacopo's, they're laboriously sewn together. Do you do that yourself?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I did a few attempts with the sewing machine, but I'm not that precise, so they all come up oddly. And also, there is not this, you know, the artisanal kind of touch, like you can see the, you know, the thread going through. Materiality is definitely like a big part of all the process. I try to include as many different technique and material as possible. I started using recently image transfer, which I quite like because it's never perfect and always look a little bit, you know, like there's some part missing, so there's a physicality to it, which I think adds something to the work. And I, the background, for example, I would like to look like walls in a street, basically, like with a lot of, you know, sedimented scratches or, you know, graffiti or whatever, just in a different way, but it's just basically, you know, showing just this layer of different way of working, in this case with acrylic, oil, pencil, oil sticks, and so on. And
but it's a playing with the idea of suturing as well, that meaning.
Yeah, that's the literal.
You've literalized that as a material.
Yeah, yeah, and then I do the same. So this kind of process happened in, at different levels. So the more, you know, playing around with history, let's say, and then there's to the level of actually putting together physically different pieces of canvas, which is another way.
Becomes part of the
collage, basically.
Yeah, but and becomes part of the play to what it means to stand in front of them.
It's like the literal thing of the other. Different level of it.
So tidy and well done now, so well made. I remember
it took me a while, but it was a learning curve.
In the early days, and the first one I have of yours, it's kind of crudely stitched
together. Yeah, with time you refine your method, but I use a lot of masking tape, which is best, most used tool, I would say. Actually, you know, to keep it tidy, because I tend to be quite messy, so with time I learn how to, you know.
But there's a lot of love in all of this, I think.
Sorry?
There's a lot of love in all of the work in this room, I think, in terms of what the artist takes to it and the time spent with these work.
Absolutely.
And hopefully that comes through for the viewer too. You have to stand in front of these works to get that impact. At a time when we're used to these circulation of images in the digital.
Yeah, definitely. I think they all encompass that idea of slowness and a longer lingering on an image than we're used to. Sure. Okay. Well, on the subject of a lot of love in the room, thanks very much, all of you, for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of the run of this show. It's on until
December 2nd.
December 2nd. So, if anyone's listening, do have the opportunity to come and see it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.